The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last week, the New Hampshire Supreme Court unanimously upheld the death sentence for Michael Addison, who was convicted in the 2006 slaying of a Manchester police officer. The ruling moved the state closer to its first execution since 1939. Meanwhile, a jury in Boston continues to hear arguments for and against the death penalty in the case of convicted Boston Marathon bomber Zhohar Tsarnaev. While the death penalty has long been a polarizing issue, an increasing number of Americans, both Democrat and Republican, are against it. Gregory Fahrenstein wrote about the increasingly bipartisan nature of opposition to the death penalty for Pacific Standard. And Gregory, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, first off, how long have American pollsters been measuring opinion on the death penalty?
Apparently since around like 1936, which is incredibly unusual. We don't have polling on just about any question going that far back, maybe on like presidential approval. But to ask about a topic-specific issue is really a treat if you're a public polling nerd.
Well, so how does American opinion on the death penalty stand today?
It is shrinking in both parties. 49% of Democrats support the death penalty today, compared to 75% in 1994. Republican support has also dropped about 9 points, 76% today versus 85% in 1984.
Any indicators as to what's behind that shift?
Well, so it's always really tough to say why people change their mind. There was this 2001 article by two legal scholars, Samuel L. Gross and Phoebe Ellsworth, that said high-profile cases in which people had been killed but later exonerated helped steer this idea that a punishment you couldn't take back was probably a bad idea.
Yeah, so DNA cases, you know, people let off of death row. We've heard a lot of those kind of stories. But I'm wondering about other big shifts through the year since we have data from so far back. Any that you know?
I can't say why, because the data just says, do you support it? Certainly the fact that there tends to be a racial tinge to capital punishment convictions, where minorities are more likely to be sentenced for capital punishment than whites. And that certainly, it may have a bigger effect for Democrats than Republicans, although I don't know, that's speculation. Just over and over again, you see the system of capital punishment where people are finding out it's crueler and more painful than we thought. You can't take it back, it's racially tinged, kind of support this growing idea that maybe it's not a good way to punish people.
Mm-hmm. What in general, I mean, we're hearing the sentencing phase of the Tsarnaev trial is going on now. Bill and Denise Richard, parents of the 8-year-old Martin Richard, the youngest to die in the Boston Marathon bombing, urged the Department of Justice to seek a deal which would waive Tsarnaev's right to appeal a death sentence in exchange for a life in prison without the possibility of parole. These kind of cases in general, you know, what is the rationale behind them on the pro-death penalty side and against?
Well, I mean, it's one of the most horrific attacks on American soil. And the guy's guilt is pretty much beyond question. He did it, and he isn't that sorry. So in this case, you might suspect that a higher portion of the American public would support the death penalty because for all the reasons we don't like the death penalty, it really doesn't apply to the Boston bombing. As far as against capital punishment for the Boston bombers, You're going to have to go back to the moral case that, you know, America shouldn't be in the business of killing people. But it's not clear that that's why most people are starting to oppose the death penalty.
Mm-hmm. So you say that the trend is that Democrats and Republicans are getting closer on opinions on the death penalty. Anywhere near bipartisan unity on this issue?
Oh, no, there's not bipartisan unity on anything.
Well put, Gregory.
You can just replace that sentence with, is there bipartisan support on X? Republicans and Democrats don't even like the same music, ice cream. I mean, they are different on just about every imaginable category of being a person.
The San Francisco-based writer Gregory Fahrenstein, he is also the founder of the Fahrenstein Wire. Thank you for speaking with us.
Glad to be here.
You can read Gregory's article, Both Parties Are Over the Death Penalty, from Pacific Standard. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Forgiveness is, of course, an admirable trait, but it takes a special individual to forgive someone who has murdered a loved one. As a teenager, O'Shea Israel was involved with gangs and drugs, and one night at a party, he got into a fight with a boy and killed him. Having finished his prison sentence for murder, O'Shea is now in his 30s. He spoke to StoryCorps alongside Mary Johnson, the mother of the boy that he killed years ago.
You and I met at Stillwater Prison. I wanted to know if you were in the same mindset of what I remember from court, where I wanted to go over and hurt you, but you were not that 16-year-old. You were a grown man. I shared with you about my son.
And he became human to me. You know, when I met you, it was like, okay, this guy is real. And then when it was time to go, you broke down and started shedding tears. And the initial thing to do was just try to hold you up as best I can. Just hug you like I would my own mother, you know.
After you left the room, I began to say, I just hugged the man that murdered my son. And I instantly knew that all that anger and the animosity, all the stuff I had in my heart for 12 years for you, I knew it was over, that I had totally forgiven you.
As far as receiving forgiveness from you, sometimes I still don't know how to take it because I haven't totally forgiven myself yet. It's something that I'm learning from you. I won't say that I have learned yet because it's still a process that I'm going through.
I treat you as I would treat my son, and our relationship is beyond belief. We live next door to one another.
Yeah, so you can see what I'm doing. You know, firsthand. Mm-hmm. We actually bump into each other all the time, leaving in and out of the house. And you know, our conversations, they come from, boy, how come you ain't called over here to check on me in a couple of days? You ain't even asked me if I need my garbage to go out.
Uh-huh.
I find those things funny because it's a relationship with a mother for real.
Well, my natural son is no longer here. I didn't see him graduate. You know, you're going to college. I'll have the opportunity to see you graduate. I didn't see him get married. Hopefully one day I'll be able to experience that with you.
Just to hear you say those things and to be in my life in the manner in which you are is my motivation. It motivates me to make sure that I stay on the right path. You still believe in me. And the fact that you can do it despite how much pain I cause you, it's amazing.
I know it's not an easy thing, you know, to be able to share our story together, even with us sitting here looking at each other right now. I know it's not an easy thing. So I admire that you can do this.
I love you, lady.
I love you too, son.
That was Mary Johnson and O'Shea Israel. Their conversation will be archived along with all StoryCorps interviews at the Library of Congress. It's more word of mouth coming up after a break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Stravinsky Suites to Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, just about every field of art and entertainment has inspired scholarly works and criticism. Comics, not so much. But then there are plenty of people who would consider comics scholarship to be an oxymoron. Comics fans are known to be a passionate and devoted lot who talk a lot to each other. but who may have given up on the idea of explaining what is comics to outsiders. Scott McCloud has. He is author of Understanding Comics, The Invisible Art. Published in 1993, it is one of the seminal volumes for comic book writers and a fascinating guide for anyone interested in the creative process. And Scott McCloud, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So a lot of American kids like you grew up loving comics and the guys in tights. When did you decide it was going to be your profession?
Well, I got into it at the age of 14 because I actually thought I was too old for comics before that. But a friend of mine convinced me to give them a try. And only a year later, at the age of 15, I decided I want to make the things for a living.
Hmm.
All the way through the rest of school, that's what I did.
Well, it is an art form, you point out early in the book, that suffers from low self-esteem. Is that was that your goal with Understanding Comics, to get some respect?
Yeah, that was part of it. I mean, certainly I felt that comics were worthy of respect, not so much for what we had done, but what we could do. Because I think all art forms really are just a blank page. You know, they're potential. And just as great movies occupy a pretty small minority of all the movies made, or great novels, a small minority of all the novels made, it was more important to me to convey the idea that comics were capable of greatness. And I do think they are, and I'm happy to report that in the last 15, 20 years, we've been finally living up to that potential.
Mm. They've been used as an art form for a really long time. You point out to us that they're pre-Columbian murals that were discovered by Cortez in the 16th century. There's the Bayeux Tapestry from the Norman invasion, and Hogarth's The Rake's Progress and The Harlot's Progress. These are historical documents for us. So what do they share as comics?
Well, all of them have this very simple idea that you're telling a story through pictures in sequence. The pictures occupy the different parts of a canvas at the same time. And what the reader does is really quite remarkable. We accept it as a kind of map of time. So as we move from one space to the next, we're moving from one time to the next. And all of these things that you mentioned and other things too, like certain Egyptian wall paintings, they all use that same basic storytelling technique. And it's something that we use today in what we call comics.
You, in the book Understanding Comics, I think wonderfully, for me, who is not somebody who passionately loves comics, but, you know, argued with my brothers and sisters over who got the funnies first on Sundays and, you know, read old classics, illustrated comics and Archies and that kind of thing. But you employ these visual tools that comics allow. And you write about the abstraction of comics, you know, rather than perfectly shaded, just the power of line enables readers to be sucked in. It gives us some kind of entry point. Why does that work? Can you explain that concept?
Well, there are different ways in which cartooning in particular, that way of simplifying the world, can really pull a reader in. One of them is that it's more universal. If you just draw a circle with two dots and a line to represent a face, you're representing every face there's ever been. Except for the occasional pirate with an eye patch, I suppose. And that has a power to it because the reader is then participating in the creation of a character, not just receiving this very detailed information about another. And in some ways, we see our own faces in that. So when you're reading Peanuts or you're watching The Simpsons, in a way, you're inhabiting those characters and seeing them as a part of yourself. And that can be very, very strong, very powerful, as it makes us feel like we're in almost a virtual emotional space.
It's that participation is with the reader that comes through so strongly in Understanding Comics. Like you point out to us the way that we read images and read into images as they move through the page. We are the silent accomplice. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, we're there alongside the artist creating the comic as we read it. The comic's only half done. They're just lines on paper until we arrive at it. So one of the examples I give is what happens between the panels. You know, there's no motion between those panels until we imagine the motion. So at one point I say in Understanding Comics that to kill a man between panels is to condemn him to 1,000 deaths because every reader is going to imagine a different scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you have one panel with the man being threatened, and in the next panel you just see the scream, you know, sort of over a cityscape. We fill in that gap.
Yeah, and that's a tremendous jump. you have to take a moment to admire the mind's ability to make that jump, to make that connection.
Do you like comics? Do you love them passionately? Do you not understand them? Well, Understanding Comics is the title of a book that's considered a remarkable new Baedeker of the tunes, says Doonesbury writer and artist Gary Trudeau. It's kind of a guide to how to make comics and how to look at them and interpret them as an art form. Well, you spend a lot of time in this book explaining how comics do work on the mind or how the brain participates, like how pictures can evoke sensation and emotional response, you know, the wavy lines rising up off the image of a tipped over garbage can or heat off a coffee cup or dizziness or pain. Why do these representations work on us?
Well, you know, it's funny because what happens is we begin by representing the world somewhat literally. And we see this in the evolution of pictorial languages, too, like Chinese. We just start literally drawing what we see. But gradually, over time, through abstraction, through repetition, they become more like language. There's something between a picture and a word that we see in these abstractions. So, for instance, there are these little sweat beads. Sometimes cartoon characters will have a little sweat bead on their forehead. And we know from experience this means they're nervous, they're upset, they're sweating, right? But gradually, cartoonists would draw that sweat bead further and further from the forehead until it became like just a marker, just a little tiny pictogram that simply indicated nervousness. And now a cartoonist could draw a robot and have that same sweat bead over his forehead,
mm-hmm.
even though he has no skin, there's no such thing as a sweat bead on a robot. But we understand it because now it's drifted into the realm of language.
Mm-hmm. Comics establish story. You know, there's momentum, there's movement from one action to the next. But yet in this book, you make many references to works of art that are established as great. You know, the static works of art, you know, Marcel Duchamp or Picasso or Munch. Do you want to establish how they operate in the same realm, comics and great works of art, or different realms? I mean, what are you trying to do here?
Well, you know, 20 years ago, I think it was more important to cartoonists this notion of some kind of equivalency, the notion that comics could go toe-to-toe with other art forms that were more established, that had a richer history, at least in the eyes of the cultural elite. I don't think that's as important as it used to be. But I do think that those connections to the broader world of fine art are still important because, frankly, everything is connected. And I think it's wise for us to always be on the lookout for those connections that, yes, this week's Amazing Spider-Man or a graphic novel down at Barnes & Noble may have something meaningful in common with Guernica. It may have something meaningful in common with, an episode of Orange is the New Black or cake decorating. You know, everything is connected. And what happens is if you look at anything closely enough, eventually you find yourself drilling down to the core from which all human expression and communication comes from. You know, all of these are different aspects of the same human instinct to communicate.
You argue, or maybe I should say demonstrate through your drawings, that the comics are one form of mass media where you can still hear individual voices. I wonder what you mean by that.
Well, you know, it took me 5 years to do this latest graphic novel of mine that's called The Sculptor. And I thought, wow, 5 years is a long time. You know, a movie only takes, say, 2.5 years to put together. But then when I go to a movie, I'm looking at 1,000 names in the credits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not even an exaggeration. I think there are about 1,000 for most movies.
You know, it always takes two songs now.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I thought, wow, I got to do this all by myself. I can't control exactly how people interpret it. But I think that this is an art form in which you have more control than almost any other.
I want to start with this idea of simplicity because we saw, you know, recently the attack in Paris against journalists and cartoonists specifically from Charlie Hebdo, the magazine there, largely for its content, but its drawn covers were the thing that really provoked people. Somebody was clearly a Muslim kissing an Orthodox Jew and, you know, saying it's stronger than hate with slobbering bits all over it. You know, these really worked on people. These really upset people.
How would that work differently than a photograph, say, or a shaded line drawing of the same image?
That's a good question. It's not one that I've considered too much. I mean, exactly why drawn images can sometimes be more inflammatory than realistic images or photographs. But that does seem to be the case. And I think perhaps the cartoonist can organize the perceptions of the world and focus them in a way that in some ways can seem more powerful than someone who's just trying to slavishly imitate the appearance of things. Mm. You know, it's funny, there's a cartoonist named Joe Sacco who's a very responsible and hardworking journalist who will go to places like Palestine mm-hmm. or Bosnia and visit with and talk to people for months, even years, and then draw very detailed accounts of his visits. And in some ways, his work seems to have more power and more veracity, even though for all we know, he could have made it all up. But somehow there's a real power in that drawn image that says, this is a personal account. I lived this, and now I'm relaying it to you with my own visual voice.
Well, Scott McLeod, I feel like I got schooled today. Thank you.
Thanks, Virginia.
Scott McLeod is the illustrator and author behind Understanding Comics, a seminal graphic novel praised by comic artists and writers from Matt Groening to Gary Trudeau. His newest graphic novel, The Sculptor, was released earlier this year. Coming up, we're going to put our newfound understanding of comics to the test when we speak with the author of A Graphic History of the Civil War. Stay with us.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among the 65,000 books written about the Civil War that ended 150 years ago last month, there are histories detailing dates and casualties and decisive battles. There are excellent portraits of generals and politicians and the perspectives of soldiers and slaves. A new graphic novel presents the war that shattered the country through a series of objects. A bullet, a flag, a pair of opera glasses, and reinforcing perspectives of history from the ground up, a bug. Not just any bug, but a mosquito with a belly full of malaria infecting soldiers and citizens. These ordinary objects become remarkable tools for a book that tells the story of a war that transformed the nation. It's called Battle Lines, A Graphic History of the Civil War by the historian Ari Kelman and the author and illustrator Jonathan Fetter-Vorm, who joins us now with more. And we spoke to him previously about his graphic novel, Trinity. Jonathan, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you.
The war that shattered a nation, the sheer brutality and the numbers of the dead and wounded and the social changes that came after. Remind us, if you would, of the scope of the devastation.
It's really hard for us to imagine now, given the conditions in which we live, in which war seems like such a distant occurrence. But the Civil War was taking place in people's backyards. People were fighting from all over the country. And in fact, it was one of the first times that a lot of residents from places like the Middle East or Middle West and the far Northeast ever got to see the South. It was transformative in a way that made people from all across the country visit other places within it. It was a vast migration of troops and material, which, you know, says nothing about the cost of lives and livelihoods. Mm.
And you could present a different type of history. All of the chapters begin with objects. We have a brick, a bullet, a pair of opera glasses, and in the first chapter, a flag. Now, how did you arrive at this device for telling the story?
Well, this I have to give full credit to my co-author, Ari Kelman. He was the one who first proposed this idea of the Civil War. It was actually while I was working on Trinity. My editor passed this proposal along, and I was a bit skeptical at first. Doing a graphic history of the Civil War is a daunting task. It's such a huge topic to cover. But when I read this proposal, I was blown away by this idea of using objects. It was very surprising. So this was really Ari's, the seed that he nurtured in this story. And we worked back and forth on figuring out which objects we were going to stick with, and some some were a little easier to work with than others. Some of his original ideas included things like the bacterium that causes dysentery, and the story was supposed to be told from the inside of a dying soldier's stomach, and which would have been wild, but I could not for the life of me figure out how to draw that.
And we mentioned that the first chapter is about the flag. This is about the attack on Fort Sumter in April of 1861. And we find out from your book, the war's first casualty was a self-inflicted wound. What's the story there?
Well, this was a crazy discovery for me. I actually came into this project without knowing much about the Civil War. The bombardment that happened at Fort Sumter, which is regarded as the real opening salvo of the war, there were some skirmishes before that, but this was when both belligerents really first started to engage each other. It lasted for days, but both sides were so well entrenched behind very thick stone walls that there really wasn't much in damage in terms of these shells hitting people, just smashing into rocks. And then when it was very clear that Fort Sumter had to surrender, that the Confederate bombardment was going to take this fort, the one condition of surrender was that the Union troops got to salute their flag as they took it down off the flagpole. And it was during this, I don't remember if it was 50 or 100-gun salute, that one of the cannons malfunctioned, and it blew up a powder magazine, injuring and eventually killing a couple soldiers who were participating in the salute. So these were the first casualties of the Civil War.
Friendly fire, if you will. Mm-hmm. You draw this book all in muted colors, designed to look like, faded newspapers or sepia-toned photos of the time. What was behind that choice?
Well, the photos, that's really the touchstone. This was one of the first wars that was so heavily photographed because it coincided with the popular dispersal of this photographic technology. So we have a huge trove of photographs to draw from, and I really wanted to try to capture that kind of sort of nostalgic, faded look, but also very, very precise, very sharp.
There is a chapter called A Photograph, and many of us have, of course, seen those horrific photos of the field after the Battle of Gettysburg, just littered with bodies of humans and horses frozen where they fell, including one that is often seen. It's sometimes called the Gardener's Home of a Rebel Sharpshooter. Now, in your retelling of it, that was a staged photograph. Did that happen?
It did. There's some controversy about exactly what was involved in that picture, but there are other photographs that historians have identified as containing the same soldier and the same gun, but in different places nearby. And so the general consensus is that this was a photograph that was arranged for effect, that likely this was a sharpshooter's den, but the body that you see in that iconic photograph was not necessarily where it was when Gardner happened upon it.
So the mythology of war was already at work, even as the battles, the bodies were falling.
Yeah, the narrative, a lot of what Ari and I were trying to do with this book was talking about the construction of the story of the Civil War, how even as it was happening, people were figuring out how they wanted to remember it and how they wanted to think about it. And as we find throughout the book, this is something that is still going on today. We're still constructing the story.
Mm-hmm. So what we're using as sources, because you do have a number of personal stories, a runaway slave, a wife left behind to take care of her family and farm while her husband is fighting. How did you come up with these kind of concepts and the dialogue between them?
Well, all the sources, a lot of them were taken from secondary material or from the letters and diaries of people who experienced the war itself. So the chapter that you bring up about the woman left behind in the South, this was set ostensibly during the Richmond Bread Riots. And there's some great documentary sources of people who kept diaries during those moments. And so there's a mixture of characters who are created from documentary sources and then real life figures who lived through the time.
Yeah, and we can see the difference in the text, that the letters written by people are written in a different sort of font than
exactly.
The stories. But there, you also tell stories about much more abstract concepts, one representing the history of slavery legislation in the United States. We see areas on the map where slavery is legal, stained with blood. But you also do this bit on, you know, you give laws form. How do you go about illustrating laws?
This was actually one of the more challenging chapters of the book. We joked about this being the, you know, the dry history chapter. It comes after the opening salvo, but it's a chance to really kind of situate the reader in the history that they need to get through. And it's a long, complicated history. The beginnings of the Civil War is still something that historians spend a lot of time debating. And we knew that we wanted to try to make this a chapter that was about multiple different viewpoints, different components that all sort of combined to create this catastrophic situation. And so just a lot of trial and error led to this idea of an edifice, the edifice of the American system. And if we have this metaphor, then each brick, each block itself is some kind of writ or law or component of the larger structure. And so from that extended metaphor, that allowed us to divide each section up into here's the brick that represents the Mexican-American War. Here's the brick that represents Bleeding Kansas.
We have piles of laws kind of teetering on these two bricks, liberty and slaves, you know, this kind of essential fight. And we do in this book also get the broad strokes of history. But I'm wondering about, for you, any of these narratives, the ground-up stories, just shock or surprise or particularly grip you?
There were a lot of them that were difficult to draw, if only because the stories were things that I had not expected. There's the extended chapter, I think it's chapter 11, Death Letter, which tells the story of the battle at Spotsylvania Courthouse, the so-called Bloody Angle, one of the late battles of the war, and it was incredibly gruesome. And in reading soldiers' accounts from the lead-up to that battle, I was, on the one hand, amazed at the poetry of the language of these soldiers who had already experienced years of unimaginable hardship, and they knew that they were coming towards some final showdown in this campaign. And then to hear about the aftermath, and that was what really shocked me, was figuring out how to represent so much destruction that beggars description and imagination, and that even for the people who lived through it, they did not have the words. They couldn't represent it. So really, this was the challenge. How do you draw something like that?
And how do you draw loyalty? There's a chapter when General Lee surrendered to General Grant at Appomattox. This was 150 years ago in April. It was a chapter called General Lee's Sword. And we hear the names of so many soldiers fallen, you know, this guy died here and this guy died here and I didn't even know that guy's name and he was this kind of moon-faced kid who helped save me. And throughout the panels, this kind of device of General Lee's sword that slowly begins to fade away. Tell me what you're doing there.
Well, the original thought behind that chapter was something about the construction of the mythology of the end of the war. There was a story that came out after General Lee's surrender, which took place in a farmhouse. And only very few witnesses were there. But there's this story that General Lee offered General Grant his ceremonial saber, and Grant politely and, you know, ceremoniously declined. Nobody knows if this actually happened, but it helped fuels the myth of gentility that surrounds this moment. And so we wanted to start with that without actually having to dramatize that and go into that myth, but I wanted to make something of that sword, that idea of what the sword represents and what the sword would then come to represent in the years and decades after the war. And so throughout the chapter, I follow this soldier as he's going back home to his farm and to his wife and family. And as he gets closer and closer to home, the vision of the sword fades from his imagination, but it never completely goes away.
And when General Grant and General Lee together negotiated the terms of the surrender at that Virginia farmhouse, this soldier, he leaves, he gets picked up on the road, and the old man says to him, "The fight ain't never over." And we think about the battle lines now, or the legacy of the war and the meaning of the war. Perhaps this is going to be the topic of tens of thousands of more books. What are you adding to that conversation?
Well, one of the things that we're doing in this book is introducing a lot of complicating factors into the easy narrative of the war. This is this is the great contribution that Ari brings to it. He has such a grasp on the historiography and on the legacy of what the war and the remembrance of the war has meant to our current culture. And so at every step of the way, every story that we tell, there is an edge to it that introduces some new wrinkle to the narrative as we think we know it. And the added contribution of doing this in a graphic medium is one of my favorite aspects of it, which is the way that we can introduce this story to a younger audience, to an audience that may not be as likely to read through the masterful tomes that summarize the history of the war. So this is hopefully a grand introduction to all of the themes that you will confront if you're willing to go further into the history of the war.
Well, Jonathan Fetter-Vorm, you've really done an amazing piece of work. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Fetter-Vorm is an illustrator and author with Ari Kelman, an historian of the new book, Battle Lines, A Graphic History of the Civil War. You can see more on the book, including a couple of selections of chapters, at wordofmouthradio.org.
Does the passive voice make you cringe? Do you scream at your screen when you see words misspelled? Up next, an argument for being more tolerant when somebody makes a grammar mistake online. That's when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thinking of posting something online? Well, be sure to avoid committing word crimes.
Word crimes. Like I could care less.
That's Weird Al Yankovic doing his bit for good grammar, and he is not alone. The grammar police bot scans Twitter and other online posts for mistakes, which are then outed in persnickety tweets like this one. It looks like at Stockholm Harry should have tweeted, and then he shows himself instead of than, T-H-A-N. It isn't an adverb. Tisk, tisk. Andrew Heisel is a writer who knows his grammar, but is not ashamed to admit that he still makes mistakes. He wanted to find out why and wrote for the Washington Post about why our brains make us write not so good. Andrew Heisel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you're big enough to confess that you do make grammar fumbles and that you occasionally take pleasure in the mistakes of others. What are some of the most common grammar mistakes made online?
The number one mistake seems to be your, Y-O-U-R, for your, Y-O-U apostrophe R-E, or vice versa. And other similar homophone slips like that, like than for than, like you mentioned, like the wrong it's with apostrophe or without, or right for right is one that I've made occasionally. You don't see that often, but I'll type it, and I shouldn't. I'm a writer. I know how to write, but I still make that mistake all the time.
Well, you looked into why. When we know the rules, we still mess up. Is it just laziness or going too fast?
I think speed definitely plays a factor into it. And you could say laziness is there, but it's mostly from these cognitive psychologists that I talked to about the way that the brain processes language. So that when you're going to select a word, first there's a part where you figure out what's the word you want, whether you have a range of related words, and hopefully you pick the right one, although often you don't. Then the next stage is sort of sounding it out, or at least usually it's sounding it out. Sometimes it's not. There's a lot of studies on this. But you sound it out, and when you're sounding it out, there's no difference between your and your. And so sometimes the wrong one just comes out. Even when you're writing by hand, this often happens. So it's not really laziness. It's just brain function.
Well, that was one of the things that surprised me, is how much is based on hearing. Now, I can hear a misconjugated verb when someone's speaking, but I get a little judgier, I guess I'd say, when somebody does it in writing or online, especially if they are sounding like a windbag or a grandstander. I mean, does
right.
that happen for you?
Absolutely. And that's one of the interesting things I've noticed. People don't correct routine language errors when it's not in any way sort of a debate. So in an internet forum where people are just talking about their interest in, I don't know, say Star Wars, and they're all in agreement, nobody's going to jump on one another for one of these little errors. But it's when there's something else going wrong, when somebody is saying something you really disagree with about, say, politics, then you go to the next level and you start critiquing their grammar. So it's interesting how Some people will say, oh, like, you know, I should correct others because everyone should speak or write proper English. But in fact, when you look at it, it's not that altruistic a motive. People are really interested in belittling others when they have some problem with their politics. At least that's the way it usually seems to play out to me. And that's honestly the way when I'm getting uppity like that, it's probably because, first, I didn't like their politics, and so second, I go to their grammar.
You also spoke to a cognitive psychologist studying Wikipedia entries to understand how the brain processes language. What did he find?
Right, and so he's in the middle of the study, so he wasn't really able to give full results. But one of the sort of preliminary theses he has going in is that often a lot of errors are really caused by proficiency. And so you'll see a different body of errors from people who know how to use a language versus ones who are maybe language learners or unfamiliar with it. Some of these errors that you say, oh, as Weird Al says, a moron, you don't know this, are actually because you do sort of know. And what happens are you build up habitual pathways of language use. And so in many contexts, you would use to, T-O-O, and so that's the one that comes out because that's usually the pattern your brain follows in constructing a sentence. And so you use it wrongly, whereas maybe a person who knows the language much less well wouldn't make that mistake because they haven't built up those neural pathways that usually work but sometimes lead to error.
So those are personal habits, Andrew. There are also cultural habits like mixing up 911 and 911. What's going on there?
Right. And so that's a weird one. That surprised me. And I think what's going on there is that sort of habitual pathway thing that the psychologist I talked to, Tom Stafford, talked about, where you see the phrase 911 so often that just typing the series of letters 911, it just comes out as 9/-11, and especially the slash one, that's not really the number. So you're just so used to seeing 911 that it comes out 911. Mm-hmm. I noticed a similar one yesterday. The word segue. When people want to say segued into something, oh, then we segued into this, a lot of people are typing it S-E-G-W-A-Y, as
like
in the
segway, like
motor
the
vehicle.
But doesn't this leave everybody out, Andrew, you know, to say, oh, I blame my brain? I mean, there are reasons that there are rules for grammar, that there's a discipline to it. We need to think these things through. Maybe there's a message here that you shouldn't be tweeting something without really considering it or maybe even proofreading.
Right, and that's a good message. People should proofread. I like to read prose that is clearly constructed and well-written. I think you should do that. But it's also true, and this is another thing that has been studied, that proofreading is not foolproof. As I just mentioned, I proofread that article, reading it through several times, and I still had that error slip. And this is because you're your own worst proofreader, because you sort of lose focus on the words you've written and you're focusing on the meaning in your brain. And this is another thing that's been studied, so that when you see the words, you don't quite see them. You see what you thought you typed, not what you actually typed. This is a problem that you can work around. I like to print things out, or just changing the font to some weird font defamiliarizes it. But you can't do that with Twitter. And Twitter is a very immediate form of exchange. So people probably should proofread their tweets, I guess, but it's not really going to happen. Mm.
I don't think that we should be shaming people publicly, because I don't think that's ever a good idea. But I'm just thinking about upholding the standards of language again. I remember speaking to a teacher a few years ago who said her middle school students pass in essays using the letter U, you know, for Y-O-U, or B, or the number 2, as they would in a text. I'm not saying it's the end of civilization if we let these kind of things slide, but, you know, where does it end?
I get what you're saying. And I've taught, and if I see that in a student paper, I would not be pleased with it either. I'd definitely correct it. I guess what I'm saying with my specific article is that you have to at least allow the fact that some of these things can't be helped because they are about the way our brain functions. But that's not to say that we shouldn't proofread. We shouldn't try to type clearly, and that we shouldn't correct people in the right circumstances. So certainly teachers should correct, certainly proofreaders should correct, and even articles, commenters should correct the grammar in articles too. But when you're just having these sort of low-level exchanges between one another, it seems a little bit useless to correct them. It's a lot like when you're speaking with a person and they're going to slip a lot. They're going to use the wrong pronoun, or maybe some words are going to
combine with one another, or maybe they'll grab the wrong one, and you don't correct them because it's sort of tedious. You're being an annoying friend if you do that every time a friend misspeaks. And that's the way I see these sort of low-level engagements on Twitter.
Andrew Heisel is a writer based in New Haven, Connecticut, and we have a link to read his article for The Washington Post, Stop Shaming People on the Internet for Grammar Mistakes. It's not their, T-H-E-R-E, fault. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McCullough.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.